Well, let's go ahead and get started in adult Bible study. There's a handout, as there usually is. I've decided to get us started on a new series. I've wanted to do this series for a long time, and for one reason or another, just didn't do it. But we've not had an opportunity in here to really do any kind of deep dive in prophetic matters. And so we're going to do that. I'm going to go through this book of Zechariah, and we're going to do that deep dive. So I'll tell you something about the handout if you're interested. This is me learning new technology, but there's a QR code on it. This QR code goes to a book I've written on Zechariah. I tried to go set it for free because I'm not trying to sell anything, but the Amazon wouldn't let me set it for free right now. When they let me set it for free, I will, as a Kindle download. But if you have $1.99, you can get it now. Or you can get a paperback if that's what you want. And though the paperbacks are just unfortunately expensive because that's how paper is. But this has really detailed notes on Zechariah. But we're going to cover all the highlights when we go through this, and probably more than just highlights. But just know that's there if it's something you're interested in. So Zechariah, a fascinating, fascinating prophet. His name means that Yahweh remembers. And the book really is about that. It's going to happen at a place in history that's important for us to understand. And I'm going to try to kind of paint that background today, the history. But he's going to minister in 520 BC. And in fact, when the book opens in the first verse, he gives you a time marker. The eighth month in the second year of Darius. So he's giving you a time marker. If you're looking for Zechariah, he's easy to miss, but he's almost at the end of the Old Testament. After Zechariah, you have Malachi, and then it comes to a close. But you have Zechariah perched there, and he's among the so-called minor prophets, which a phrase a Jew would never use, because it gives you the idea that they're unimportant prophets. After all, they're minor. I had a minor in at the university. It was a bunch of classes I didn't want to take, right? But minor only meant shorter than Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, the longer prophets. So the rabbis call these guys the 12. The 12 are from Hosea forward to Malachi, the 12. And you should think of it that way. And Zechariah is not a short book. It is either the most messianic Old Testament book or the second most messianic behind Isaiah. That is, it says more about Jesus than any other Old Testament book. Zechariah is also one of the most ignored Old Testament books because it's difficult in places to interpret. But he gives us his time marker, eighth month, second year of Darius. We're going to talk more about that guy, Darius. But this puts us in October or November of 520. Well, what month is it? All right, we're at the end of October. This man's ministry starts about the time we're standing here, but go all the way back to 520 BC. He gives us a time marker, and then when you get to verse 7, which is where he'll start the next vision, he'll give you another time marker, February 15th. He's specific about the day, and scholars can trace it to the day, but you know, he tells you the 24th day of the 11th month, February 15th, 519 BC. Okay, so it's cool to have those time markers. The later prophets, Ezekiel and many others, Haggai, Zechariah, they tend to give you time markers where you can figure out where you're at. So, but I want to start reading something first from Genesis. I read this a couple of weeks ago, and so I'm not going to belabor it that much. But when you read your scriptures, the whole Bible is written around these covenants, these covenant promises in the scriptures, particularly the promises Abraham. And then there's a covenant that God makes with Moses that we talk about sometimes called the law covenant. And then there's this concept of the new covenant that becomes prominent in the book of Jeremiah, the book of Ezekiel, the book of Zechariah. So we have all these covenants. They're important because they contextualize what's happening. With the covenant with Moses that you read about in the book of Exodus, it includes the Ten Commandments and other things. Exodus 24, the people say, we'll do everything you told us to do, and of course they don't. But they were told what would happen if you don't do everything that God told you to do, And God gives lots of warnings, and he spends centuries giving warnings, but eventually the hammer falls. And when the hammer falls, they are taken captive for 70 years in Babylon. The nation, not the whole country, but the southern part of the nation is taken captive. The northern part had been taken away a long time earlier. But in 587, 586 BC, so we're Zechariah's 520 and we're counting backwards. So going from Zechariah backwards from 520 to 586, 587, Nebuchadnezzar takes, destroys, overruns the southern part of the kingdom, takes the people captive for 70 years. God had told them, and you can read it in Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus 26, they're really long chapters, but he tells them exactly what will happen. And he basically eventually says, look, if it continues long enough and you won't turn back to me, I'm going to bring in people who don't speak English. And those people who come in who don't speak English, their language is Jewish folks in the ancient world, they're going to overtake you and they're going to take you away. And that's exactly what happened. So when you're reading the prophets, the reader knows this concept of this covenant with Moses because they're living it. It's a covenant that binds them. But there's another covenant back in Genesis 12 that I'd mentioned a week ago. And this is when God picks Abraham. It's not a covenant with Israel, but it's a covenant with Abraham. God selects Abraham in Genesis 12:1, and he calls him out of the place he lived called Ur. The town was Ur, U-R. He calls him out of Ur to go to this promised land. Doesn't tell him where he's going to drive the bus to, but he says, I'm going to take you there. Just, trust me. And so the Lord said to Abram, this is before God changed his name in Genesis 12:1, go from your land, which is elsewhere identified as Ur of the Chaldees, go from your land, in other words, leave your land, leave your house, leave your relatives, leave your father's house to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. The book of Genesis is about that happening. By the time you get to the end of Genesis, what has happened? You've had a man who can't have children, right? They had went to all the fertility doctors in the day, and him and Sarah couldn't have children. Now they've got children. And their children have had children, and their children's children have had children. And now, you've got Joseph, who's a child. You've got Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. Joseph has been promoted to prime minister of Egypt. So all these events have happened. And this couple that had no children are starting to form a nation. He takes those people, Joseph and Jacob's sons, and they stay in Egypt for 400 years, and they become a nation. But by the time that 400 years is over, you got a million or more people. So this promise is going to be kept, and you're going to see it happen with Genesis and Exodus. I'm going to make you into a great nation. I'll bless you. I'll make your name great. You'll be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you. I'll curse anyone who treats you with contempt. You could add a little parenthetical there, Hamas. All the people of the earth will be blessed through you, right? So here's the problem. You read these glorious blessings, and when you look at what happened in history, you fast forward. You get to like King Saul, King David. Things are going pretty good with King David, man after God's own heart. King Solomon, they have more land, more territory than they've ever had. But it just gets bad after that. The kingdom splits into two. You've got Solomon's stupid son in the northern kingdom, and you got another one in the south, and just all kinds of bad things are happening. And you fast forward, eventually the northern kingdom, because they split, that northern kingdom falls, and the southern kingdom falls. And now, this destruction that Nebuchadnezzar brought in 586, 587, it left it in total ruins. There's just nothing to look at in Jerusalem. It's a pile of rocks. There's no walls, and there's no temple. It was drastically destroyed. Then they're in captivity for 70 years, and a small group of people, when God says you can go home, very few people go home because it's a pile of rocks. There's just nothing to go home to. But some go home. And God is going to revitalize the nation in its homeland, and that's where Zechariah and Haggai come in. The first thing they do is they get there and they start building their houses. They build a place to live. But they haven't rebuilt the temple. And you can't have Israel revitalized without the temple. You need to revitalize them physically, rebuilding the city, eventually the walls of the city. That's the book of Nehemiah. But you need to rebuild the temple so that their spiritual life returns, and they have this focus. So in a broad picture, Haggai and Zechariah want them to rebuild it. But if you're one of them and you return to Jerusalem, it's a pile of sticks, in rubble and in rocks, you're going to be a very unhappy person. You can imagine it being a time of great despair, I think. And so Zechariah wants to be an encourager. And he's going to do that. He's going to be an encourager. I want to read a little bit of history from the book of Ezra. Ezra is not a hard book. You should go read that whole book if you haven't read it recently. Just go read it sometime. It's a lot of the background for Zechariah. Ezra tells the story of the people coming home. When do they come home? If you were to read the fifth chapter of Daniel, it's this wonderful chapter, and Nebuchadnezzar's gone. There's a young man that's a king, and he may be a grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. There's some debate about that. And he's there, and he's really, he's not the actual king, but he's in charge when the king is gone, because there are all kinds of problems with the king there. A guy named Nabonidus. But you've got this guy there in Daniel 5 who's having a big party. You know what happens. He's having a big party inside his castle in Babylon, in the palace, and he thinks to bring out all that stuff they had stolen from the temple. Nebuchadnezzar had stolen from the temple in 586, 587. The year is 539. Nebuchadnezzar's dead, and this young ruler's there. Let's bring out God's stuff from the temple, and we'll use it for our party. Now, what you don't really get the idea of is when he's doing this and they're all getting drunk, all the nobles, there's probably 1,000 people there or something. Outside the city walls, outside the gates, is a big army led by a Persian king named Cyrus, now called Cyrus the Great. They win that night. Cyrus gets into the city, quickly overtakes them, and Babylon as an empire is finished. And now you've got a new empire that's the empire that's a conglomeration of the Persians and the Medes, but another group of people. But the Persians is Cyrus. He's a Persian. So when you're in Daniel 5, that's literally the night the kingdom falls. And after he gets all of God's utensils from the temple and they start having their big party, and you know what he's trying to do? He's trying to get all those nobles sauced up so he can convince them he's not really worried about that big army outside, when really he's scared to death about that big army outside the gate. There's thousands of troops there. They're not going to be very kind. They're not going to follow the Geneva Convention when they get in there, you know what I'm saying? So he's trying to talk his talk, but then there's this hand that appears and it starts writing on the wall. It's reminiscent of that time in the book of Exodus when God took his finger and he started writing the Ten Commandments. He starts writing that on the wall, and they can't figure out what it says on the wall. And as he says, well, we need to find a smart person. So they decide to go to an older generation of people. There's this guy that's been put out to pasture named Daniel. And they need him to come interpret because they can't read it. And of course, it says, you've been weighed and found wanting, basically. And it's funny because he says, Daniel, if you'll decipher this code, I'll give you half the kingdom or something like that, promise. And of course, Daniel's thinking, yeah, I'm going to have that for the next hour. What's that worth to me? So anyway, he deciphers the code, and that guy falls that day. Cyrus comes in. What's significant about Cyrus coming in is Cyrus is happy. Let me say this. When he comes in, he's viewed as a liberator. The populace, right? Can you imagine liberating North Korea? The populace isn't viewing Cyrus as an invader. He's a liberator from this fool that's been in charge. And Cyrus's public policy, his national policy, is if Jewish people want to go back to Jerusalem, let them go. And that's a big deal. That's a turning point, because they have been 70 years in captivity. They're not allowed to go home. There's the fear that if they were to stay home, they would mount a rebellion or that sort of thing, which had happened before. The reason Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the city in 586, 587 is because Zedekiah, the king at that time, mounted a rebellion. God specifically told him, don't mount a rebellion. If you do, this and this and this will happen. He didn't listen to God, mounts a rebellion, and it's bad. But that's why they wouldn't let him go home. They didn't want another rebellion. The Persian guy, Cyrus, he's like, yeah, you can go home. Not only that, let me give you some stuff to start rebuilding. Here's some money, and, you know, that kind of thing. So it's a turning point in history, and it gets you to the book of Ezra. So Ezra chapter 1 says, I'm just going to hit a few verses. I just want you to get this idea that you've got this rich history book in Ezra that really is the context for Haggai and Zechariah, who are literally preaching at exactly the same time. Their ministries overlap, and Haggai is an older prophet, and Zechariah is a young guy, but they're preaching at the same time in 520 BC. And what's the backdrop? It's the book of Ezra. So there's the decree of Cyrus, Ezra chapter 1, in the first year of King Cyrus of Persia. This is the guy that won the battle in Daniel 5. In order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken through Jeremiah. Well, what did Jeremiah say? 70 years of captivity, then you can go home. God now working through a pagan king to send his people home. It says the Lord roused the spirit of King Cyrus to issue a proclamation throughout his entire kingdom and to put it in writing. And then here it is. This is what the King Cyrus of Persia says. The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth and appointed me to build him a house at Jerusalem. Cyrus wants the temple rebuilt in Jerusalem. Go figure, right? And so any of his people among you, may his God be with him, and may he go to Jerusalem and Judah and build the house of the Lord. He's giving them permission to return. And then as you read on, he'll start describing what they were able to take with them, the people that returned, and he lists the people. Chapter 2, my editors wrote, the exiles that returned. They're returning around 538. Daniel 5, the fall of the city of Babylon, that's their Washington, D.C. That was 539 B.C. So within about a year, people are on their way back home. And it lists out all these families by name. They kept careful records. What has happened? Why did God take the people to Babylon for 70 years and now he's bringing people back? Is there a difference between the people who left and the people who came back? What do you think? Yeah, and how are they different? There's one real big difference.
They're getting rid of their pagan gods.
That's exactly it. God pleaded and begged with them to give up their idolatry, and it took taking them on vacation to Babylon for 70 years to get the idolatry out of them. When they, as God would say it, I'm going to show this to you in a moment, when they came out of Egypt, Egypt wasn't out of them. That idolatry, those practices in Egypt, would just track them all the way through until this moment. Now he's going to take back a refined remnant. When you get to the Gospels and you're reading Jesus' ministry, you don't find them worshiping idols anymore. But you read the Old Testament and it's just all the way through it. So that's what's happened. I'm fast-forwarding a little in Ezra. I just want to catch one other thing here, and it's up in, to make sure, I think I want chapter 6 here. And I've got some notes on some of these verses. I want chapter 5 first. Ezra 5, verses 1 to 3. Now, before you get to Ezra 5, let me say this. In Ezra 3, at the end of it, from verse 10 through verse 13, they rebuild the foundation of the temple. Okay? What temple was there before? The one Solomon built. That one was completed around 970 BC, thereabouts, not an exact year. Solomon was the successor to King David. It was one of his sons. Solomon built the temple. David wanted to build the temple. Solomon ended up building the temple. It was a marvel to behold, and it was gone. It was just completely destroyed. In fact, one of the things that happened when they started to build the new one is there were some people alive who, as young children probably, or teenagers, had saw Solomon's temple, and they were really, you know, like, well, this temple isn't going to be like Solomon's. You know, people start grumbling. But they only finished the foundation, and that's Ezra 3:10. When the builders had laid the foundation of the Lord's temple, The priests dressed in their robes and holding trumpets, and the Levites descended from Asaph holding cymbals, took their positions to praise the Lord. So there's a big celebration. It was a big thing. We laid the foundation. Cyrus wanted the temple rebuilt. He no doubt was giving the people what they asked for. The foundation is laid, and here's the problem. They stopped. Right? No one's ever started a home improvement project, right? Like redoing the bathroom, and you knocked out the old toilet, and then you stopped. Something like that. Yeah, I'm the only one, right? Yeah, right? They stopped. They were done. And that's the problem. So this is, you know, in the 530s. When you fast forward almost 20 years to Zechariah, they've already got bass boats, and they've added on, you know, made an extra room on the back of the house and all that kind of cool stuff. And the temple is still just a pavement. It's just a foundation. But they were very careful to put it where the original was, and that's important. And that foundation is still there today. You can go see it. But it has an unfortunate structure on top of it. So chapter 5, verse 1. But when the prophets Haggai and Zechariah, son of Iddo, this is Ezra chapter 5, talking about Haggai and Zechariah, son of Iddo. This is common to say son of sometimes when it's a grandfather. Iddo is his grandfather, a priestly line. But it says, when the prophets Haggai and Zechariah prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem, in the name of the God of Israel who is over them, Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel. Zerubbabel is going to be a key character throughout our book of Zechariah. He's the governor. He's the political official that the Persian king has put in power. Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, son of Jozadak, began to rebuild God's house in Jerusalem. The prophets of God, Zechariah and Haggai, were with them helping them. This is fast forward in time. Now it's not just the foundation, but they're actually building the temple. And then if you look in chapter 6, verse 14, chapter 6, verse 14, so the Jewish elders continued successfully with the building of the temple under the prophesying of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah son of Iddo. They finished the building according to the command of the God of Israel and the decrees of Cyrus, Darius, and King Artaxerxes of Persia. It's taken a lot of time. Okay, a lot's happened over that period of time. The house was completed on the third day of the month of Adar in the sixth year of the reign of King Darius. This is, you'll see a time marker when we get to Zechariah 7. This is probably about 2 to 3 years after that last time marker in Zechariah's prophecy. He was a young man, so he probably lived to see this, but it's just to say, mission accomplished. He's going to go preach, you need to finish this temple, and they do. And he does it by encouraging them to do so. So with that in mind, let's turn to Zechariah. I hope a little of that context helps. People have come back. They've come back to a very difficult job of rebuilding. It would be easy to be in some despair. It would be easy to think that those promises that I read from Genesis 12 are gone. It's important at the beginning of the book that Zechariah tells this new remnant, those promises of God way back in Genesis, they're still good. That's the key for them. They're still good. And what's more, he's going to build on it and get to this idea of a new covenant and a coming Messiah who he says is going to live physically in Jerusalem. So it's going to be a wide-ranging history. It's a book of encouragement for the most part. These people haven't per se done something wrong. The only thing that they did wrong was that they let that foundation stay for a long time without getting the work done. And Haggai, if you read Haggai 1, he really kicks them in the rear end on that. But that's what's going to happen. And it's going to culminate in chapter 14 with Jesus' second coming to rescue Israel from something we would call Armageddon, from a battle. It's going to culminate in Armageddon. It's a wide-ranging book, so that's what we'll get there. Let's look quickly. I've got an outline here. I just want to show you. This book's real easy to outline, which is a help. Some books are hard to outline. There's a prologue in the first chapter. It's the first six verses, and we're just going to go through that real quickly in a minute. But first six, and I've got an outline here on my notes, but first six verses are a prologue, And then in chapter 1, verse 7, the editors of my Bible wrote the night visions, the night visions. The prophet makes his first message in that prologue, first six verses. And then you skip to verse 7, and it's a few months later, but he's going to see eight different visions in a single night. It's a fascinating thing, and I wish I had a way to show you. I've got this picture that's, I have it framed at my house. I tried to take a snap of a shot of just a little bit of it to put at the top of this page, and you can't hardly tell. If you look at the version I'll post online, you'll be able to tell a little bit. But anyway, this artist that I used to know, he's deceased now, but he took all eight night visions and painted, or you know, drew them with a pencil on one canvas. It's this beautiful picture where he mixes all eight of them together. But because they all happen in one night. They're all part of one message, even though we'll call it the eight visions, it's all one night. I'm thinking he didn't sleep a bit that night, because as soon as he sees a vision, there he is kind of being roused awake. The vision isn't always easy to interpret, but he's going to have this angel with him that's like his tour guide, and it's going to help him interpret. So from chapter 1, verse 7, through the end of chapter 6, are the eight night visions. At the tail end, the second half of chapter 6, it's going to prophecy about Jesus being the future priest king, which is a scandalous thing. You can be a priest and you can be a king, but everybody knows you can't be both unless you're like Melchizedek from the book of Genesis chapter 14, who was both a king and a priest. And that's the subject matter of half of the book of Hebrews. So it gets set off by what happens at the end of 6. Chapter 7 and 8 present four, so we had eight night visions, four messages about the Messiah in chapter 7 and 8, and this wonderful passage about fasting. I can't wait to get there. Hopefully no one will have eaten breakfast the day we talk about fasting. And then chapter 9 to 14 is a lengthy section that has two what he calls burdens, a heavy weight. And they're like three chapters each. So you have like 9, 10, 11, and then 12, 13, 14. They're two burdens. Eight visions, four messages, two burdens. Everything is about Jesus. The whole book. Everything turns to Jesus. What he's trying to do is, instead of telling them by simply speaking to their moment, that they should build the temple, which is largely what Haggai does. And you should read Haggai. He's two chapters. Easy read, and it's a good book. But and it's the book right before Zechariah. That's why it's put there, because they're preaching at the same time. Zechariah tells people about the future to change the way they live today. And that's not hard to understand. If you know you're going on vacation in 6 months, you make a lot of plans and it changes a lot of things you do now, because you know in 6 months you're going to be in such and such a place, right? He is telling them about the future to change how they live now. And it happens. It works. They need to know that all those promises are coming true. There's still a coming Messiah. All of that stuff. And he packs it in here. So let's look at the prologue itself. This seemingly simple message. He says, in the eighth month, second year of Darius. Darius is a name you see in the book of Daniel that threw the 80-something-year-old Daniel in the lion's den, even though he didn't want to. Remember, he kind of got forced into doing that for political reasons. This ain't him. That's a different Darius. And this guy is the actual king of, you know, a successor to Cyrus. These guys, you know, he's good to Israel, but he's not a good guy. He got to be, you know, now people get elections. They may be fraudulent, but they get elected. Here, you just killed the prior guy and took over, and that's what he did. Okay? So you see, what's his right to rule? He killed the other guy. Yeah. Well, and this is his second year. So he begins to reign in 520. He will reign for a long time, all the way until 486 BC. So that's like 35, 36 years of being in power. He's there a long time. But he'll be good to them. He lets them continue their rebuilding. But he's just giving us a time marker. And it's Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, son of Iddo. And this is where you get the idea that even though it said son of Iddo in the book of Ezra, Iddo is the grandfather. We know nothing about Berechiah. This is not the Zacharias that Jesus says died and was murdered in the book of Matthew. I'm not going to go into that, but you may recall there's a couple of Zachariases in the Gospels. One is John the Baptizer's father. The other is one that Jesus said was murdered. This ain't him. The timing's all wrong. That's just a different guy. But anyway, Zechariah, he says, the Lord, now he's speaking for God, the Lord was extremely angry with your ancestors. Now put yourself in that time period. You're a Jewish person. In what way was he extremely angry with them? Well, he brought the Babylonians to town, and they weren't very pleasant. They took the whole city, and when you read that history, 2/3 of the people died. That's how bad it was. So it was just a bloodbath. And then he took people away into captivity. So yeah, he was extremely angry with their ancestors. They know it all too well. I mean, this is history that a lot of them didn't live it directly because they were born in captivity. In other words, they were born in Babylon, these younger people. But they know about it. It was things their parents and grandparents told them what happened. This is what the Lord, in my translation, says armies in verse 3. Older translations say the Lord of hosts. The King James will say that, maybe the New King James. It's host of armies. These people have come to a city with no walls, no way to defend itself. It's largely in ruins. Who's going to keep them safe? He's going to make these promises. I'm taking care of you now. And I have the ability to do it. He's the Lord of hosts. God is pictured in a sense as a great general or soldier. And this will come out when we get to the first night vision next week. Because if God the Father is the Lord of hosts, who is the one actually taking care of Israel? And I'll try to show you next week. It's the Son of God. And we'll see that. But God says that he's the Lord of hosts. And here's what he says. Return to me. This is the declaration of the Lord of armies. There's a telling statement. When you go before the destruction, before the fall of Jerusalem, you have Jeremiah preaching to them. That's the book of Jeremiah. That a lot of his ministry is before the fall. Ezekiel is another one, preaching to them before the fall. And he gets to a point where Ezekiel's warning about what's going to happen. The fall hasn't happened yet, but it's about 4 years out. And in Ezekiel 22, he says, here's your root problem. You forgot me. You just forgot me. I mean, when you read Romans 1, you kind of get how that happens. It starts with just kind of a lack of thankfulness to God. And before long, they've replaced God with little figurines and stuff. They had forgot him. And he's calling this group of people to remember, to learn from their history. So return to me and I will return to you. You'll read that. I'm not going to turn there. But James chapter 4, verse 8 says basically the same thing in the book of James. It's a principle you can stand on as an individual. If you get far from God and you'll turn back to him, you're going to have that sense of him turning to you as well in your life. It also works here with this remnant. He says, you return to me and I'll return to you, says the Lord of armies. Don't be like your ancestors. Well, how are they like? Well, for one, God sent prophet after prophet to tell them to stop doing what they were doing. What were they doing? The biggest thing was idolatry. God calls it the detestable things. That idolatry included all kinds of sexual sin. They made what were called the, quote, high places, because if the gods with little g are up in the clouds, you need to build you a place of worship up in the mountains so they can see you better. Can't see you out on the ground, so you get up there in the mountains. And they were generally fertility gods. If you could arouse them, they would cause the rain and you'd have crops, that kind of thinking. You certainly sacrificed your children to those gods. That was a common practice. So people will look at this and say, oh, that's also awful. God went in there and destroyed the city. These people were as bad as they could get. And there's even a point in Ezekiel where he says, God says in the whole city, there's not one person that could possibly lead these people to turn back to me. It had gotten that bad. So that's who they were. That was the ancestors, the idolatry. They oppressed the poor. They had the you know, a lot of them had the money. to take advantage of the poor. And it was one of the things God says a whole lot about in the book of Ezekiel, just that kind of corruption. So lots of things going on. But he says, don't be like them. The earlier prophets proclaimed to them, this is what the Lord of armies says, turn from your evil ways and your evil deeds. But they did not listen or pay attention to me. He's not quoting a particular prophet. He's summing it all up. What did Jeremiah say? What did Habakkuk say? What did Ezekiel say? When you read the book of Ezekiel, it's so long, but in the opening three chapters, he calls the prophet, and then he tells him right out of the gate, you know, he's just fresh out of seminary, and he's all, you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and ready for, you know, new challenges, very, you know, he thinks it's going to be all easy. And he's like, they're not going to listen to you. You're going to preach your heart out. They ain't going to listen to you at all. But if you don't warn them, then I'm holding you accountable. If you warn them and they don't listen, I'll hold them accountable. And as you read the book, Ezekiel brings message after message telling them, I'm going to, you know, in very specific terms, I'm going to take the city out. I'm going to take out the king. I'm going to do this and do that. And in the text is clear. They just don't believe him. They don't. In fact, they don't believe him until they're in the city and the armies are outside the city going to take it. I mean, it's all of a sudden like the light starts to go off. Oh, well, why was that? Well, because they didn't like the message. No one likes to hear a message that's negative, even if it's true. And they had false prophets that they could watch on TBN and on the radio and listen to them that said, they're not going to take you. God's going to totally deal with the Babylonians. There's no way they'll ever take you. So when you don't like the message and there's other people willing to give you an alternative version instead of what the Bible says, it becomes something that people do. So, and that's true today too. We call it progressive Christianity. They reject almost everything about the Bible because they don't like what it has to say, and someone else is willing to give them what they like to hear. So that hadn't changed. People are just people, and people have always been that way. God is calling them. He says, return to me and I'll return to you. Meaning with all the blessings, all the promises, don't be like your ancestors. The earlier prophets warned them. They didn't listen. Turn from your evil ways is what they were told. Well, but they didn't listen or pay attention to me. Now the question is, where are your ancestors now? And the answer generally is they're all dead. Most of them died when Nebuchadnezzar brought his armies through. I mean, 2/3 of the people died. So God told them over and over through numerous prophets what would happen. They said, no, it won't. It did happen. Now you're looking back, kind of like Monday morning quarterbacking, and they're like, yeah, everything God said would happen, happened. So, but this group has been refined, like they are faithful, and they're looking back, and they're willing to accept it. So God asked kind of the rhetorical question, where are your ancestors now? They're gone. Do the prophets live forever? No. Daniel's gone. Ezekiel's gone. These prophets are gone. What remained? But didn't my words and my statutes that I commanded my servants to the prophets overtake your ancestors? That remained. This is a call to them to recommit. As they begin this journey where God's going to lead them through the prophets to rebuild the temple, he's calling them to commit. So the people, look, it says this, they repented, verse 6. And they said, as the Lord of armies decided to deal with us for our ways and our deeds in the past, so he's dealt with us. They have finally recognized what the people who lived that history never did, that everything God said through his prophets was 100% true. Everything he said in the law, the Torah, about what would happen was absolutely true. This is a sign of hope. This is a recognition for the first time that what God said was true. And it prepares them now, okay, they've looked back and said, you know what, we should have listened to the prophets. When Zechariah speaks in the next vision that we'll cover next week, they're going to listen. That's going to be the big change. These people don't have, he doesn't need to beat up on them. They're ready to listen. God had to take millions of people out and bring 50,000 of them back in to get a group of people who would do what he wanted and didn't have no idolatry. So this is what will happen. I encourage you, try reading from chapter 1 through chapter 6 during the week. Like, read, because it's all in one night. We can't, it'll take us 6 weeks to cover it, maybe 7. But for Zechariah, this was just one long evening. And I guess he wrote it when he woke up. I don't know. But you should read it. You'll see it's some challenging stuff, but good stuff.